listening to a journalism.co.uk podcast. Most people will be able to name at least one of the international journalists killed during the Arab Spring. But what about the citizen video journalists who've been killed for bringing us scenes from Syria? What about those who've lived and died to share video footage from Libya, Egypt, Tunisia and elsewhere? Frank Smythe, Senior Advisor for Journalist Security at the Committee to Protect Journalists.
You've seen a number of foreign correspondents killed in Syria, all in homes, but you've also seen a number of citizen journalists being killed. One is Anas Al-Tarsha. This is a journalist, in fact, who had filmed a protest and a demonstration in support of the two foreign journalists who were killed earlier this week in homes, Marie Colvin and Remy Ochlik. Anas Al-Tarsha filmed a protest in the streets of homes of people demonstrating against the Syrian government and holding photographs of these two international journalists who had been killed. This citizen journalist himself was killed two days later, and then you also have seen Rami Al-Saeed, who was another citizen journalist who was instrumental in uploading very instrumental images that had quite an impact in the outside world. He was killed just over a week ago in Syria. So
Harat Al-Farsi is a 24-year-old Libyan born in Libya but raised in the UK. He reflects on the death of citizen journalist Mohamed Nabous, who died 11 months ago in Libya.
With the tragic case of Mohamed Nabous, he was tragically murdered on the 19th of March, literally hours before the UN resolution came out to enable the no-fly zone, the resolution 1973, which he was so desperately calling for in the morning while I was listening to him before he went out and was tragically killed. And he was, you know, Benghazi was being shelled, and he was still going out. People were telling him to stay at home, don't risk yourself. And the effects of that are, you know, rippled across the whole of Libya, and I think, you know, across the international spectrum. He left behind a wife who was pregnant with a beautiful baby girl, and these pains and the losses are experienced after his death, and they ripple, and they will continue to be felt by his family and by similar people who have lived his situation and who continue to do so even now in Syria. So it's both on a personal and I think also on a professional level. I think the effects are felt on many, many spectrums. Even non-Libyans, and we're speaking about from the international press, there were professional journalists who were detained. The New York Times journalists were captured and they were abused. And so there was always a danger of not merely people fighting with each other using weaponry, but there was, you know, the media and the camera lens, and so that was also a means of fighting the regime.
I asked Frank Smythe of the CPJ if we have any idea how many citizen journalists have died.
Well, it's unclear how many citizen journalists have been killed in Syria, Libya, and other nations, but certainly dozens of journalists and activists, if not, and that may be a conservative number, have been killed over the past year, along with some very professional and experienced journalists. And I think what this shows is that increasingly citizen activists, citizen journalists, are the ones who are on the front lines of reporting activities that are occurring in nations that are under siege, in many cases by their own government, or where there are ongoing clashes between opposition and government forces. Syria has denied access for international correspondents to enter the country, to be able to get visas to enter the country legally, so a number of journalists have been entering the country illegally. But what has compelled these international journalists to enter the country have been the video images and still photograph images that have already been uploaded to the internet from homes and elsewhere in Syria by citizen activists, bloggers and citizen journalists who are out there with cell phones and other handheld technology devices in order to capture what is occurring and then upload that to the internet and get that out to the outside world. So in this kind of situation, the boundaries between who is a recognized journalist and who is a citizen journalist are certainly breaking down.
Back to Haret al-Farsi and how he started collecting, curating and translating citizen journalist reports from Libya.
I'm a web developer by trade, and when the Libyan revolution began last February, it was a spur of the moment decision. I decided to do whatever I could to help my country, and so I decided to start a blog online called LibyaFeb17.com. The purpose of the blog was to try and put some order, I believed, into the flood of videos and material, news material that was going to be coming out of Libya, with a main focus of making that material available to the international media and news sources by translating everything that I possibly could into English.
He talks us through the risks for citizens filming footage while Gaddafi was still in power.
The risk and the danger is obviously of being caught with that material on your phone. There were also reports that the army and the police and security forces were going around checking whether people had some kind of internet signal or some kind of connection, some kind of internet connection in people's homes. They were actually driving around apparently in trucks that were able to detect that. And so it wasn't purely a matter of being on the street trying to discreetly record footage, but it was also, I mean, that was the first stage, which was of huge danger. But then there was the second element of, if you were found with an internet connection in your house, then that was considered at the time an act of treason and an act that was not serving the interests of Libya. You were considered to be working with the West and with the enemy. There was also the issue and the danger of people's faces appearing on some of these videos as well. So sometimes we would get messages where people would say that, you know, if you're able, could you please blur out, you know, this part of the video, or can you please, I said something or I mentioned somebody's name, so can you try to kind of mute the sound in this part? Because just as much as people wanted for the news to go out, they were obviously worried for the safety of others, and they did not want to be putting others at risk whilst, you know, trying to get the truth out of the world.
The risks that Haris al-Farsi spoke about in having the technology to transmit footage from Libya is a current concern in Syria. Frank Smythe from the CPJ is currently advising journalists there.
There's some concern that citizen journalists and others are using satellite phones to upload images and video of abuses and attacks that are occurring inside Syria to the outside world. And a number of technologists have made it clear, and I've also blogged on the Committee to Protect Journalists website, that there are in fact several ways to track a satellite phone through its radio emissions and using other technologies. And so anyone using a satellite phone needs to realize that it could actually be tracked and used for targeting ordnance or for military attacks. So it has to be used in a manner, generally in a limited manner, for no more than 10 minutes, and some people would argue that even that is not safe, before switching it off, even taking out the battery and changing location. So we're very concerned about both citizen and professional journalists who are working now in Syria.
Khalil Gorbal is from Tunisia and now living in the US. He's one of the project leaders of Speak Out Tunisia and co-founder of Le Pacte Tunisienne. He talks us through the dangers faced by those in Tunisia who set up Facebook pages in the days after street vendor Mohamed Bouazizi burned himself on December the 17th, 2010.
The Tunisian government and the ATI, I mean the former agency, internet agency provider in Tunisia, were tracking and trying to steal information and, you know, gathering information about the administrators of these pages and who are the guys behind. These guys got some troubles. Two got arrested, or even three actually got arrested. Two bloggers and one singer, rap singer. Got arrested right before the revolution, and because these information were stolen, I mean, their login and their stuff were stolen. I mean, they were known before. One time, these guys tried to organize peacefully strike in Tunisia, saying that we are fed up with the censorship of internet, and they called themselves 404, you know, in regards when you try to load a page. And you have this 404 error because the page, I mean, because you cannot access the page, so they call themselves 404.
One of the ways Tunisians avoided detection was by using a proxy server to surf the web anonymously.
And actually, all Tunisians know how to use proxies. It's amazing. I mean, everybody knows how to use a proxy and how to get out and try to get the information from outside.
More than a year on since the revolution in Tunisia, and Khalil Gorbal is now turning his attention to training citizen journalists.
So the project Speak Out Tunisia we are working in now is sessions, many sessions of training. So we will bring in Tunisia experts in citizen journalism, and we will try basically to teach what is citizen journalism. Means that, first of all, of course, techniques, tools, softwares, how to edit photos, videos. And the second part is the deontology and ethics of journalists. Means that, of course, the citizen journalism has played a huge role in the Tunisian revolution through many videos and photos on social networks and mainly Facebook. But right after the revolution, we have seen also tons and tons of wrong and false informations, which lead us basically, you know, to rethink and reteach what is the ethics of a journalist.
Omar Hamilton is an activist and filmmaker and co-founder of Egyptian citizen video journalist collective Mosserin. I caught up with him a couple of weeks ago while in Egypt. He told me about the number of citizens killed since the uprising in Egypt started.
At least 1,400 people have been killed since January 25th last year. So the police are very, very violent. The army can be violent. There's lots of shotguns. So it is quite dangerous filming. Because you have to get close, because especially after a year of, you know, battles with the police, like, just filming tear gas isn't enough anymore, you know, to get something that people sit up and pay attention to. You know, you have to get something more, and you have to be trying to, you know, get them doing something particularly nasty. So it's difficult, and Salma Saeed's one of our members, a good friend of mine, and she got shot very badly last week. I think he has like 45 pieces of shotgun in her body and we still can't walk properly and so on. So it's difficult and it's dangerous, and the Egyptian Journalist Syndicate in November actually made a statement saying they felt that journalists were being targeted, people with cameras were being targeted. So there is definitely a sense that they go for the cameras. There's nothing really you can do about it except try and, you know, run at the right time, which is kind of, you know, just after everyone else but not before it's too late.
That's Omar Hamilton's theory on risk. But what is journalist security expert Frank Smythe's advice on how to assess when it's worth taking a risk?
For people on the ground in Egypt, like you're talking about, in Cairo or in Homs or elsewhere, it's really a judgment call. And what I tell people when it comes to risk is there's nothing more intimate than the decisions you will make about how much you are willing to risk your own life and perhaps that of others who may be with you in order to get a story. I mean, I've made it clear that I think this is actually a decision which is more intimate than sex, because ultimately the implications can be much more severe and will last far longer. So it's really a personal choice, and I think it's very difficult for anyone to judge anyone else about how much they're willing, if they're risking too much or too little to get a story, because that's a decision that only the people on the ground can make, and everyone has to make it for themselves and then either live or literally die with the consequences.
You've been listening to a journalism.co.uk podcast.